Okay, Sue. Steve, back to you.
Okay.
We got a couple of little flip chapters here.
Yes.
Thank goodness flip chapters are quite short. I picked them again. They're condensed. You know, they don't. Unlike Maycutt and Morehouse, where it keeps repeating itself. Flip doesn't do that. At least it's condensed, but it's short. But it gives you enough
to
of it.
Read.
Yeah,
there was a lot packed into seven.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, don't worry.
There was a lot packed into seven.
I broke that one down, don't worry. I got 3 pages.
It was compact, but...
okay.
Chapter 6 is the notion of entering the field of research, and this is from the perspective of a researcher. I'll start with asking, are there any questions that perhaps I could try to address first before what I had prepared was essentially an overview of the different sections and how they seem to fit together. Okay, I will assume there were no questions. There's a quote on page 53. How does the researcher secure the collaboration of his or her potential participants in the study? How does he or she achieve not only that a willingness is expressed, but that this also leads to concrete interviews or other data? It's on page 53. And that's on page 53, and it simply poses the question, if you're trying to engage with a particular field, or I like to refer to it as a community of practice, how do you get them to actually want to engage? I was reading Lisa's blog, actually, and it helped identify a few things as not being here last week, the notion of terminology for oneself, the researcher, or as Flick refers to the people, or refers to the researcher as, is the participant observer, the client, the researcher as stranger, the visitor, the initiate, gains access to the field under study, usually by starting with a dialogue. The notion of a cold, neutral researcher is a myth. For the researcher must ask questions to explore the field, and in doing so, their actions become the instrument through which data is collected. That actually goes against what I thought was the role of the researcher or the interviewer in qualitative. It was to be detached. It was to not make value-oriented comment statements or questions, and essentially not trying to fish, as somebody should have referred to it as, to what I was doing as. But it would seem as though without the researcher's active participation in the interview process, the data you will get will be irrelevant for the most part, and it won't really get you anything more than just superficial information or superficial data.
Kind of gets it's typical of suggesting that by supposedly remaining detached and objective, that you're not therefore imposing anything on to the interview, and that goes against the whole idea that it's a social interaction. You are having a role, you're playing a part in the social interaction, so you might as well acknowledge that role and instead of try to screen it out, see how it's actively producing putting forth information, bringing forth information.
Everybody may want to tag figure 6.1, as I thought it was quite useful to refer back to later. And here, from perspective of a researcher entering a field, we have a list of the different types and levels of participation, and essentially what the particular field in which they reside. Here they observe members, interact with members, participate with members, investigative participant, membership roles are peripheral member, active member, complete member, and good faith membership. This one bothered me. This one really bothered me, the good faith membership. And I couldn't get past some of the ethical implications of entering into a dialogue as a member of a field and it being anything other than action-based research. And I couldn't really... If you're engaging at that level, you're looking at your own practice in order to understand the different social interactions that are taking place within the group and the different processes and so forth. So how are you able to then take a step back and do any type of analysis there?
Mm-hmm.
And I had trouble with that.
Okay, that's a good point. And we'll touch on that a little bit later, slightly, when there is a process whereby you are attempting to make what is known strange. Okay, that's how people discussed it. So trying to take something and create a sense, that's partly where bracketing comes into play too. It's not just about putting your own assumptions away, but it's acknowledging enough of how you view something that you can actually render the familiar somehow strange enough that when it's strange, you'll see new possibilities, new modes of interpretation in it. So that's one way in which people address that, say it is possible. And another one is suggesting too that it depends on the level of analysis that you're interested in. So if it's descriptive, then the insider knowledge that you have by being there is also, if you like, illuminating in its own right, and therefore wouldn't necessarily have to be strange from that perspective. If you want rich descriptive from an insider position, but again, someone would have to acknowledge that this is my subject position on this.
Bottom of page 56, Creme de la Creme. Essentially a quote, but accessing institutions here, hospitals, businesses, schools, etc., offers its own challenges, for each institution has its own priorities, which it may not necessarily see as being served by the intended research. And I open the quote. Research unsettles the institution with three implications. One, that the limitations of its own activities are to be disclosed, and I think we've all come across that. Two, that the ulterior motives of the research are and remain unclear for the institution. A lot of the time this is, even with the research design, taking it to an individual, they don't necessarily...
They don't believe you've told them everything.
Don't believe they've told you anything, and sometimes even accessing the level at which you want to engage and analyze, if it's not necessarily an academic institution, with people who are of a certain level of training, they may not be able to access what it is you are trying to gain.
Right. And I think that's really a hugely important point for us to just dwell on for a second, is that we often feel that we're going to be the most open when we go into an institution, when we lay up all our cards on the table and tell them what the research is for and why we're doing it. And we're really excited about it because it's our research and we know lots about it because we've been studying it at this level. And we think everybody's going to be as excited about what we're interested in. And so we dump all this information on people with the expectation that that's somehow doing the right thing and being the, you know, forthcoming and ethically better and all kinds of things, right? But the agenda behind that, you know, it's what this is trying to ask you to do, or what your thinking is you've got to think really about the agenda behind that is and where what it's really serving, what purpose is it really serving, just to make you feel better or just to let you sound off that you love this area and it's just so great and everybody should. You know, how is it actually really helping the person you're dumping all that information onto? To know that much. And so that's being selective in what you tell people in a different way from trying to be covert, you see. So you're not trying to hide anything when you go in, but you're also realizing you've got to manage that information, okay, because it's really not going to be serving the people involved well if you just give them everything.
Provide too much information, then they can game the system and totally mess up your results.
See, that's not what I mean, but it doesn't surprise. That's a very, very honest and out there interpretation all the time. Yes, I do not believe, okay, fundamentally, that people can mess up your research because they know what you're doing. Okay, and if they could, then I think you're probably not doing something that's ethically sound.
Can you give an example?
Well, what were you thinking?
With entrepreneurship, I don't really see it as too much of a problem because the entrepreneurs usually acknowledge that they're getting free consulting out of all the questions that you're asking them and really helping them think about their business. But if you get them to think about it too much, then they might get honed in too much on your research question and lose sight of the bigger picture of where their business should actually be going. If I'm studying a really simple relationship, if A and B, and they might assume that that relationship takes precedent over all other relationships that might affect a similar outcome.
Okay, so in other words, you're getting at that they're going to tell you what they think you want to know and ignore other parts of the story.
The latter, not the former part. Yeah.
Right. Right, so they'll think, well, you're oh, I see, ignoring other parts to sabotage your work, no?
Whether intentionally or not.
Okay.
That they would be drawn towards too much of the phenomena that I'm interested in.
Okay. I think that's an important point. I think it's a related, maybe not even as related as you think, but a different point from the one about presenting a lot of information about your study as therefore then being somehow going to arm an individual with...
It puts them more in the position, whether it's intentional or not, that the effect, the observations that you make might be exaggerated to some degree.
Okay, so let's say then that what you're meaning is that you want to go in, when you're interested in an area like entrepreneurship, you want to go in giving as much of a broad description of your interests as possible. Right, so that there's lots of potential for someone to take it off into their own avenues, even though you may be only interested in one little bit. You're not going to say, my only interest in you and entrepreneurship is this tiny little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you believe that's all they're going to give you. Mm-hmm. Yep. So you want to start with a broad brushed approach. Now that doesn't go against the qualitative idea of presupposition, does it? You can go in there thinking that you've got an area you're interested in particular. But remember, the whole point was you wanted to be open, though, and you want to produce a method, or use a method that's going to be able to provide, you know, the potential for new things to emerge, or for at least to possibilities outside of that area that you kind of have an intuition about or you think about. You want to be able to be broader than that in your situation. So I think all of that's going to reflect how you go into your institution in the first place.
When Marty gave his example, the example that came to my mind was, for example, doing research with people who are in mental health facilities, for example, like mandated clients or, you know, sort of captive audiences,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I can see that they might try to play the system more. They might be more skewed to bend your research a little bit because they want to be presented in a favorable light.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting concept, though, because, like, I'm sure about what you said, you want to tell them something about your research, but you might not want to tell them everything you're measuring, or else they might play it to their own advantage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or to appease the researcher?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's right.
Yeah. So we've got two different issues, just to make clear. One issue is not to tell the researcher everything about, or the institution, everything about what you're doing in a form which you believe is being open and honest and fully transparent because of the role of the whose agenda it's serving issue, right? Like, is that really, you know, useful to them? Is that just going to overwhelm them? They're not going to understand it all at that level. It's going to, you know, what's that going to, it's going to distance me even more from the institution and the participants, okay, because there isn't going to be a common language that we've been working on. There's that, and then there's the, if I tell them certain things about my research, will that then make them want to portray themselves in a certain positive light, or make them want to give me certain pieces of information because they think that's what I'm after and it'll please me, and all those kind of researcher effects, right? Biases, okay.
Actually, I just thought of something else. It's kind of unrelated, but kind of related. But I think, well, the topic that came to my mind when you said that was ethics. Like, to be ethical, you have to disclose a certain amount, don't you?
Yes.
Like, open and honest. I forget the exact words, but that's kind of a fine line then, too, isn't it? To be an ethical researcher as compared to messing up your research.
I think in qualitative research, we're a little more fortunate, even though, than those that are going in specific hypotheses. They have much more trouble, I would imagine, in the extent to which they disclose, because they've formalized a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. The qualitative researcher can actually be honest about the fact that, you know, I've got some ideas. I don't have to share all those ideas because they're my presuppositions. They're what got me interested in the field. They're what gave me an insight into this would be an interesting area to study. But the fact that I'm now going to study it is I'm going in with an open mind. And that's what I need to reveal to my institution, that I'm coming in with an open mind. It's only at the analysis stage that I'm going to go back to really studying those assumptions I came in with and seeing how they've been opened or broadened or panned out or, you know, had an impact on what I went in with to begin with. But I feel that ethically we're okay. We're on pretty solid ground there to not have to reveal our kind of ideas, because they're just that. They're not, you know, set firm when we go in.
Mm-hmm. Is there then a differentiation between the institution and the interviewee?
No, that's just the layers, isn't it? That's different layers. But
okay.
So when I'm saying that, it could be in this case just one interviewee you're speaking to.
Yeah.
It depends on access and permission. You've got the layers, right? If you're going into a school, you usually need to start, let's say you're going to school but you're only interested in two children interacting in a classroom. Well, you've got to have permission that layers and layers, right? That goes by. So it's got to be the probably working back, you might have to start with, in the UK, pretty much start with the Board of Governors, but maybe you get to start at the level of the head teacher, you know, who's going to then have to get the staff on board, the individual teacher in the classroom on board, the children and their parents on board, and so on. So you've got those layers. And every layer, you have to satisfy for ethical approval, you know, that you have that informed consent's been obtained and permission granted at every layer, every level.
But then, going back to Marty, or to Marty's question, I guess I have difficulty then in that I don't have to share why I was originally interested in, as you said, mm-hmm. in the topic.
No, I wouldn't think you have to know to satisfy ethical. Why would you have to say what your personal interest is?
Okay. Even though that might be what the exploration of the research might end up.
The area of research interest that you have, that's what you're focusing on.
Okay.
But your own preconceived ideas about that area, no. Those don't, I wouldn't think, have to be disclosed to create any ethical problem. Because you're not going in there trying to prove your theory, are you?
No.
If anything, you're going in there trying to broaden out from your initial preconceived ideas. And that's allowing for the very notion of why we have ethical research, that it's not to pinpoint or pigeonhole people going in. It was to say, okay, you know, I've got my own idea. Everyone's got their own ideas, own opinions about everything in the world, right? Even things they have no experience of. So it would be ridiculous to suggest that that had to be the fundamental disclosure.
Okay.
Let's say you're interested in studying something that's controversial, like victimization in schools, okay? And you're going in and you actually believe that schools are, the very way in which schools are set up creates much more traumatic effect on victims, okay? Just the institutionalization of schools. So you believe you want to study the whole setup of a particular school. So you're going to be looking at its bullying policies, you'll be looking at the way individual children feel about telling on other children, about how bullies in the school feel, how victims in the school feel, all the whole kind of gamut you're interested in going in and looking at. And your idea, of course, is already that there is that structure, something within that structure is going to, you know, really set up this a worse, if you like, conception of being a victim. Okay, so if I go into the school and say, something about your school, I believe, okay, is really setting up these kids to be victimized. Okay? That's what I'm interested in finding out.
Come on.
Okay? All right. So let's say, okay, is that, did I do, first of all, the ethically appropriate thing in revealing that to the school? Did I provide information that's useful to the school to know? Okay, all those questions have to come up. Whose agenda was I serving in revealing that to begin with? Mm-hmm. And doesn't that go against everything we've been reading about being sensitive to the schools that we're going into, knowing that that's going to cause defensive and upsetting reactions? We want to go in with as little upset as possible. So you have to weigh that up against your moral sense. Remember, ethical and moral are close, but they're not the same, right? What you have to do is, ethics are an agreed set of principles. Morals are value-laden, right? They're very different things. So you might morally feel like a liar. That's for you to reconcile personally, isn't it? You might morally feel, oh, I lied to that head teacher, but I'm in, you know. You might have to live with that. But ethically, as a principle, you may have behaved very professionally, in a sensitive, professional manner, one which didn't say, here's my preconceived ideas that I'm throwing on the table at you, and that's all I'm going to go in with, and I'm going to make you already think that's all I'm going to go in with by telling you initially that that's what I believe. That's all I'm trying to give you, is a sort of wide stretch approach. All those things, there's no easy answers. But in saying there's no easy answer, it's not clear cut either to say you're doing always the right thing by putting all your cards on the table for all kinds of reasons.
I think that part that I keep forgetting, especially now when I ask my question, is that it's very much exploratory, inductive research, not this is the question that I'm out.
That's what I tried to say, didn't I? Like you're in pretty good ground being a qualitative researcher. From that standpoint. Go ahead.
I'm so grounded in quantitative that I keep forgetting about the inductive part, and that's something that came out last week, lecture, that you're not sure what you should be looking for, what we're doing is correct, whether the themes we've chosen are appropriate or complete. And the thing not seen at first could be, hold on, I've got that typing there. But basically that you can lay on the cards at the table, because in inductive research, you really don't know what you're going to find out.
Yeah. Look, let's turn that moral angle one more time in its head, just to show how powerful it can be. Who am I to know what's going on in that school? I've never even been there before. I don't have children in the school. I'm not a teacher there. Who am I to go in and say, you know, I think there's something in this institution that is causing victimization? You know, it's an equally powerful thing to say, how ethical is that? This outsider coming in, right? But the inductive approach of saying, I don't know, I can have those views and it might be something that I look at in my research, but the point is that there may be a lot of things I'm not seeing that may really well go on. It may, a lot of barriers that may have not be within the institutional structure of the school, but rather at a much more personal level, key players in the school, that might emerge. And I would never have known that, so. There's lots of philosophical layers to this. That's why we have so much trouble with ethics and moral philosophy.
That's why we have SFU Ethics Board.
Yeah, let them decide. Yeah, but you are on a pretty good ground of qualitative if you keep that open mind and open approach. And also if you are remembering that you are the researcher, right? Not your statistical tables, and right, you. And so you've got to go into any situation, any environment where you're doing research, remembering you're the research tool. Okay, what kind of research tool do you want to be? You want to be a, you know, threatening research tool? You know, do you want to be a pushover research tool? Do you want to be, you know, you've got to represent yourself in this process. So that's something, that's what I try to think about when going in, and that informs a lot of my decisions about what I then need to say or need not to say. A lot of it's about self-reflection first, knowing yourself and your role first, and then you will be able to present a very good case for going in. Okay, and it also makes you appear to those as if you perhaps have a lot less of that so-called hidden agenda if you've actually examined your own positions first. It's okay. Okay, let's.
I can quickly finish in 2 minutes.
Okay.
The third reason that institutions are sometimes uneasy or unsettled about research is that there are no sound reasons for refusing research requests. That one made me laugh, because I think a lot of the time we hear in, not necessarily this course, but others, that, oh, well, they can come back and say they don't want you there because.
Yeah.
Then to read it in that perspective of, well, actually none of those are legitimate. No.
They're excuses.
They're excuses, and they're biased in a certain way.
Yeah. I thought that was beautiful. You know, beautiful thing to start thinking about. Okay. Because if you think of it that way too, it helps excuses, you can sometimes you can sometimes come to some kind of agreement, right? Some kind of middle position where excuses are present. But if they're reasons and they're based in some, you know, area outside of your control like that, then we wouldn't get research done. So it's saying you take the excuses that you get from institutions and you look and see whether or not compromise can't be found. You know, then you look at where the excuses are coming from. If they're based on, they seem to be coming from an area of fear or ignorance, or you can, there are sometimes ways in which you can alleviate those things. But it's a way of feeling like, you know, there's some potential within your ability to work with access, as opposed to just completely shut off and say, oh, they said no, I'm out of here. You know. I had, when we were doing bully victim research at Keele, some of my students wanted to go to St. Mary's School down at the end of the road, and this PhD student of the colleague of mine was in that school doing research, or had been in that school doing research, and when I approached the head, who I knew, I taught her daughter actually at Keele, so she was very sweet and lovely head teacher, and she said, you know, she said, we'd love to have you and your students in the school, but the last person that came in, you know, he was just didn't work out. You know, he just really upset a lot of teachers. Well, it turns out this poor PhD student, very bright young man, no social skills, zero social skills. And he just went into the school and, you know, just did create a really bad impression that reflected really badly. You know. Now, sounds like a good reason to me why she would be refusing him, right? Okay. Did we get to go into that school and do our research, though? Yes. Okay. Because I could then take that on board and say, okay, let's do something about that. I said, well, the people that I send in, then I'm going to come and supervise them in the first visits, you know, and tell me how you would like those students to behave in the school. We'll have a code of behavior that they will adhere to. You know, I'll make sure that it's discussed with them. And, you know, let's give it one more try. Let's see if, rather than just someone just coming in without, you know, enough close attention, you've really alerted us to a problem. Can you help us work on this problem so we can ensure that our students go into your school and leave a good, favorable impression? Yeah, so they went into the school. But I could have easily thought, oh, forget that. You know, there's, as would a lot of people. And sometimes it doesn't work, of course. There was another case where a teacher wouldn't let us go into his school at all because he said just mentioning the word bullying in our research was going to, you know, put that thought into children's heads. Huh. Like, you know, it had never been there before. But when we come into the school and say the word, and there was no moving him. End of story. No access. So. But then you have to remember that's neither an excuse or a reason, is it? That was just his own psychosis. No, I'm just kidding. No, but it was his own mindset there. You know, that's quite different. You can't deal with somebody who won't come into the realm of reason. Okay?
Very quickly, box 6.1 on page 59, just list the roles of the researcher in the field, stranger, visitor, initiate. And insider. The insider one I thought was fascinating because as an insider you have insights into understanding the methods, processes of actions, viewpoints, organizational principles of social groups from a member's perspective. Again, I guess we've talked about how you would separate yourself after the fact, but I had a question pop into my head, and it was, is it possible to take a limited role but gain insights into a member's perspective through the quality of questions? For the quality of responses, without having to engage at that high level of being an insider or an initiate, and I wasn't sure how to answer that, so I'll pose it to everyone else. And dinner time.
Yes. Should we think about that at dinner? Okay, let's do that then, and just say. Yeah, thank you. I know it went off on a tangent. I did, as usual. But we will come back to look at access and ethics again in one particular class. We've got some readings focused on it. So it was just a bit of a taster to get thinking about it. And we'll see. It's a really complex area. Thank you. Right, have dinner. Enjoy. And come back at about, 22?
Yeah.
It's a big typeface.
I'm probably going to leave it here. Is everybody leaving? What's the door thingy again?
1 and 3 together.
1 and 3.
And then 2, 5, 4.
Okay. I'll agree not to prop the door open. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Thanks, Steve, for that.
Yeah.
Somebody might have like.
I'm still behind.
I know. It's horrible.
Oh, I don't really need to record the air break. I don't know, maybe.